Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Philosophers and neuroscientists differ on what makes a person, meaning how is the self constructed? Does the soul or another more mystical power work alongside the brain to make a person who we are? Here to tell us about her new book and theory that the self is determined solely by a person's brain is Patricia Churchland, Professor Emerita of Philosophy at the University of California, San Diego, and the author of the new book, Touching a Nerve, The Self as Brain. Hi, Professor. Welcome to WNYC.
Hello, Brian, and greetings from the Northwest.
Can you explain, first of all, what you mean by the word self?
Well, I think that self refers to a kind of conglomerate of things. It's the awareness of where we are and what we're thinking right now, but it also has to do with our sense of having a past and an autobiography. It has to do with our sense of the kinds of capacities we have. You know that you can swim or that you can read. It has to do with skills, with weaknesses that we believe we have, and so forth. So I think that it's kind of a multiple variable set of operations, and it's probably simpler in other animals, and it's extremely complex in mammals and birds.
So in the book, you tell a story about your childhood where you had to confront a nasty dog to deliver eggs to a neighbor, and your sister told you to not show fear and to be confident as you walked up to the house, and it worked, and you made it past the dog. Now, I think if I were to think about a situation where I had to consciously push fear away, I might think of it as myself telling my brain to do that. But that's not where you would land, right?
Well, no. It's a useful way, I think, of conceptualizing it. Probably the truth is that there is some set of circuitry in the brain, probably in the prefrontal structures above the eyeballs, that are controlling other structures in the brain. So it's circuitry interacting with other circuitry. And so control really is this very intricate set of interrelationships between parts of the brain. So it's not like I am over here, a spooky thing, and then there's the brain, the physical thing, and the brain is somehow manipulating me. I am some part of the circuitry and activity of the brain itself. That's me.
So how does it help people to know this or to make this distinction or lack of distinction between self and brain that you're trying to establish?
I think in many ways it provides a relief when we understand, for example, why we fall asleep. That it's not a kind of decision on the part of the ghosty soul, that's really an important rhythm that the brain requires of us. Or when we feel, say, a long cocktail hour, we start thinking fondly about a cold California Chardonnay. Is that just the spooky soul that's intervening, or is it the brain that comes to have a certain expectation based on past experiences? The relief, I think, comes for those people who have neurological conditions such as tics or who have particular kinds of obsessions or phobias, and it helps to learn that these are not conditions for which they just need to exercise more gumption, but they are conditions that are probably rooted in their neurobiology, and that even if they can't be changed by current medicine, it helps us to understand what they are and to kind of try to live with them and work around them and work with them.
Although I guess I could argue that even that establishes a self different from your brain. If you can have that self-esteem that grows from knowing that these behavior problems that you have are from a physiological brain condition, then there is another self. We're getting really philosophical here, but that it was another self that is knowing that.
Well, there's another part of the brain that knows that. And that's a part of the brain and its activity that is identified for us as part of ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still, I mean, the thing of it is that there doesn't seem to be any independent, non-physical thing out there that somehow in some mysterious, non-scientific, bizarre way interacts with the brain. So it all seems to come down to the brain, although bear in mind that having said that, the brain is not, you know, a sort of simple device like a mousetrap. It's an extraordinarily complex device, one that is capable of creating for us this sense of self that kind of unifies our experiences and our memories and our understanding of our nature.
So listeners, today on the show we've been through Secretary Kerry's mission to bring peace to the Middle East. We've been through growing up out of poverty into the middle class. We've been through the rebuilding on the Jersey Shore and whether they're doing it the smartest way. So now give us your calls on yourself and your brain. If you have any thoughts or questions for my guest, Patricia Churchland, Professor Emerita of Philosophy at the University of California, San Diego, and the author of the new book, Touching a Nerve, The Self as Brain, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And you're right about large and small deceptions that some people choose to believe, and a belief in heaven is on your list. So is this an anti-religion book to some degree?
Not necessarily, because there are many religions that don't buy into the idea of an afterlife in which we continue to exist with our current personalities and memories and so forth. But I do think that there is something liberating about recognizing that maybe just like other biological creatures, when we die, our memories and our personality, which are all rooted in the brain and structured by the brain, that all those things go too. And that maybe we need to invest here on Earth in making community and in making the environment better and preparing a life for our progeny, rather than supposing, well, it'll all be fixed up when I go to heaven and all of my motivations of a deep kind need to be oriented towards an afterlife. I think that it's very liberating to realize that the here and now pragmatically matters a huge amount.
So just so you know what kind of a geeky crowd we have listening to this show, as soon as I put out the phone number, all the lines lit up. So let's hear from some – they may not be the same people who are calling to talk about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but they're there. Mark in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Brian. I'd like to ask the professor if she believes we have any free will or if we're just purely deterministic beings and we're just conscious robots, basically.
I think we're not just conscious robots in the sense that I think the kind of control that brains have evolved over many, many millions of years to have is very complicated. And we're beginning to understand the differences between brains that can exercise meaningful control, that is, can stick to a goal, can resist temptation, and so forth. We understand the differences between brains in control and brains that are not in control. And actually, it feels different as well. So that if you are pushed, that feels very different from having made a movement as a result of a decision. So I think that there is something very deep and very meaningful about control and decision-making and taking into account future consequences, as opposed to someone who doesn't do that. And the brain-based differences we really are beginning to get a bead on. it's not robotic in the sense that there is no flexibility. The complexity of the circuitry of the brain is exactly what allows for an adaptive response to changing conditions. My computer doesn't really respond very well to changing conditions. My brain, even though it's a causal device, its causality is so rich and so intricate that I can adapt to changing circumstances. I can make a decision according to probabilities and so forth. Yeah.
Thank you, Mark. Ingram in Rye, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, hello. Thank you. I had brain surgery in 2006, a tumor on my front, I think, left lobe. Mm-hmm. And when you were speaking about the self, and I just wanted to know exactly, how does that affect the brain when you have a brain tumor and then it's removed? I'm the same, but I'm not the same to me.
Do you feel like your personality changed as a result of your brain surgery? Is that what you're saying?
Slightly. I mean, for the most part, it's like sometimes I'm living outside of myself. I know there's a difference.
Mm-hmm.
I'm more like the same, but I know there's something different, and I can't figure that out.
And so, Professor, is there something about your understanding that might help Ingram, you know, to maximize happiness in her conditions?
I think that is a really fascinating question, and it resonates with other accounts that we have from patients who have had frontal tumors followed by surgery. Often, if the surgery is confined to one side, just the left frontal lobes or just the right, there can be minor and very subtle changes. But if the surgery involves both right and left, then the changes can be much more significant. Mm. And in those cases, it's often that the emotions and the control system is changed in such a way that often very poor decisions are made. A famous case was studied by the DiMaggio's of a man who both before and after surgery had an IQ of about 140, but after the surgery, where both left and right frontal lobes were lesioned, he made very, very poor decisions, and he would do things that in retrospect he thought was absolutely crazy and ridiculous. But at the time, somehow the whole control system and the role of the emotions in signaling that something was inappropriate had changed.
Well, I wish we had more time. And Ingram, thank you for your call, and good luck to you. We have so many interesting questions that we're not going to be able to get to. People who want to ask you about depression, people who want to ask about mental illness being situated in the brain. Therefore, people say you can think your way out of it. Can you really? You want to give us maybe 30 seconds in our last stretch here on, you know, something that might respond to either of those?
Well, that, of course, covers a huge territory, but certainly we are learning much more about the nature of depression in its very many guises. But we are also learning that people's attitudes and responses to their illnesses can also make a difference. Now, this isn't, again, that it's some independent soul that's manipulating the brain. It's really rather that the brain takes a certain stance towards the illness and says, you know, I'm going to work my way through this and have a positive attitude. And we know that that can help enormously.
And we do have to leave it there. We'll have to have you back to answer more of those questions in detail sometimes, and others that people are calling in with about understandings of the soul and different parts of the brain and stuff. But we will leave it there for now with Patricia Churchland, author of Touching a Nerve, The Self as Brain. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brian. It's an honor.